Our text this evening is Psalm 62. Psalm 62 is a great psalm because it teaches us that God alone is our refuge from treachery and oppression. Psalm 62. My soul waits in silence for God only. From Him is my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I shall not be greatly shaken. How long will you assail a man that you may murder him, all of you, like a leaning wall, like a tottering fence? They have counseled only to thrust him down from his high position. They delight in falsehood. They bless with their mouth, but inwardly they curse. My soul wait in silence for God only, for my hope is from Him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I shall not be shaken. On God my salvation and my glory rest, the rock of my strength, my refuge is in God. Trust in Him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before Him. God is a refuge for us. Men of low degree are only vanity, and men of rank are a lie. In the balances they go up. They are together lighter than breath. Do not trust in oppression, and do not vainly hope in robbery. If riches increase, do not set your heart upon them. Once God has spoken, twice I've heard this, that power belongs to God. And loving kindness is thine, O Lord, for thou dost recompense a man according to his work. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Oliver Cromwell didn't read this psalm many times and find comfort in it, that in the midst of oppression and tyranny, as he had in his day, and as we have more subtly, but growing less subtly as the years go by in our day, our one and only refuge from oppression and tyranny is not revolution, it's not violent acts, it is for us, as it was for Cromwell, the living God. And we pour out our souls before Him, and God hears and answers our prayers. In the meanwhile, no matter how alluring and attractive and convincing the oppressors may be, and no matter how much they offer you to trust in them and to depend upon them, do not trust in oppression, and do not vainly hope in robbery. If riches increase, do not set your heart upon them. And no matter how powerful tyranny may be in our day, remember what he said here, power belongs to the Lord. And God recompenses to all men according to their work. Last Sunday night, you saw the movie Cromwell. Tonight, and we just barely introduced him. So tonight and next Sunday, I want us to begin looking at this man pretty much in detail. Because in 1847, 200 years after Cromwell, one of the greatest historians that ever lived, by the name of Daubigny, who's written hundreds upon hundreds of pages on the Protestant Reformation, said that Oliver Cromwell was the greatest Christian since Martin Luther and John Calvin. This is 1996. In my estimation, Daubigny's statement still stands true. There have been great Christians throughout the history of the church, but in my opinion, there have been three really great Christians since Paul: Augustine, Calvin, and Cromwell. Cromwell was born August the 25th, 1599, in Huntingdon, England. He was raised in a moderately wealthy, influential family that was thoroughly Puritan in its faith. On August the 22nd, 1620, he married a well-bred Puritan woman by the name of Elizabeth Borcher. And for the first 10 years of married life, he lived as his father before him on his estate, giving himself to farming, to industrial and social responsibilities, as all men of wealth had to do. After Queen Elizabeth died in 1603, her cousin, James VI of Scotland, she named to be her successor as the King of England. So on his way from Edinburgh to London to be crowned King James I, he stopped at the estates of Oliver Cromwell's uncle, whose name was Oliver Cromwell. And while there, it's not unlikely that little boy Oliver, the nephew, probably played with the young son Charles of James I of England, whose head would be lost a few years later because of Cromwell's influence. After James I left Oliver Cromwell's uncle's house, he told him that he had been treated better than anyone else since he left Edinburgh in that household. So as a reward, he knighted Oliver Cromwell's uncle, Sir Oliver Cromwell, and came back throughout his long career many times, frequently, for hunting and shooting expeditions. It's interesting how the Stuarts and the Cromwell families came together early in life. In fact, there was some Stuart blood in the Cromwell family. In his early adulthood, Roman Catholicism was beginning to reappear in the courts and palaces of England. But the gospel of sovereign grace was flourishing in the house of Oliver Cromwell. And he was occupied with his flocks and his fields, his children, the interests of his neighbor, and above all, into putting into practice the commandments of God. Salvation had come to his house, and he intended to be a thoroughly Christian man. And last week, as we read from his letters in this great book, and I've ordered several copies, The Protector by D'Aubigné, you see documented the godliness, the extraordinary godliness of this man throughout his life. In 1628, and I keep track of the time, born in 1599, married 1620. 1628, he was elected to his first parliament. And in 1629, he gave his first speech in parliament when he was just 30 years old. There was an eyewitness who recorded it. All eyes were turned upon him, and the house listened to him with attention. He wore a plain cloth suit, which seemed to have been made by a bad country tailor. His linen was not of the purest white. His ruffles were old-fashioned. His hat was without a band. His sword stuck close to his side. His countenance was swollen and reddish. His voice sharp and untunable, but his delivery was warm and animated. His frame, although exceeding the average height, was strong and well-proportioned. He had a manly air, a bright and sparkling eye, and a stern look. And you want to guess what his very first speech in Parliament was about? It was against the reestablishment of Roman Catholicism in England. And that was a consistent note that he struck throughout his whole life. For him, the revival of Roman Catholicism and the culture and the superstition and the tyranny that it always brings was a real threat to the Protestant nation of England. This was not some fantasy. It was not some exaggerated fear. It was not because he was always looking for some conspiracy lurking in the background. It is because in his day and time, a counter-reformation that would restore Roman Catholicism to England was a real threat. Think about his history. Henry VIII didn't like the Pope, set himself up as the head of the church, but kept espousing Roman Catholic doctrine. Bloody Mary, Queen of England, devout Roman Catholic, butchered hundreds of Protestants and was bent on killing all Protestants in England. Elizabeth I, under whose reign he was born, was a woman who was so pragmatic that she tried to synthesize and compromise both Roman Catholicism and mild Protestantism. James I, the great pervert and tyrant, hated Scottish Presbyterianism, hated the English Puritans, and was always in some kind of conspiracy with people on the continent who were Roman Catholic. Charles I married a Roman Catholic, the French princess Henrietta Maria, and he later conspired with Irish Catholics and with Rome against Scotland and England. After Cromwell came Charles's two sons, Charles II and James II, both convinced of Roman Catholic doctrine. Both said there was only one way to interpret the Bible, and that is by Roman Catholic perspective. Both, particularly James II, butchered and brutally persecuted the Protestant Church, during whose reign thousands of Scottish Presbyterians were done to death. And so, this first speech that Oliver Cromwell gave against Roman Catholicism was not some exaggerated fear. He preached against it, spoke against it all his life, because it was a real threat. He did everything he could, committed all of his life and energy and wealth to the stopping of any counter-reformation in England that would bring England back under the tyranny and superstition of popery. Well, during this time period, the more he got involved with Parliament, the more he became aware of the atrocities of Charles Stuart, Charles I of England. He was shocked at the tyranny that he saw of Charles over church and state. He was shocked at the brutal oppression of the English Puritans and Scottish Presbyterians by Archbishop of Canterbury William Laud. He was shocked at the conspiracies of Charles and the Earl of Strafford, Wentworth, regarding the use of an Irish Catholic pagan mercenary army to be brought against Englishmen. And he was sickened by all the other bloody plots and dishonesties and deception of Charles I. All these things were more than Cromwell and the English Puritans could stand. But it was the martyrs under Charles I that filled Cromwell's soul with horror and anguish. Let me read you about one. A man named Dr. Bastwick. As Dr. Bastwick ascended the scaffold on which he was to suffer mutilation, his wife rushed up to him and kissed the ears he was about to lose. Upon her husband's exhorting her not to be frightened, she made answer, "Farewell, my dearest, be of good comfort, I am nothing dismayed." On descending from the scaffold, he drew from his ear the sponge soaked with his blood, and holding it up to the people, exclaimed, "Blessed be my God who has counted me worthy, and of his mighty power has enabled me to suffer anything for his sake. And as I have now lost some of my blood, so I am ready and willing to spill every drop that is in my veins in this cause for which I now have suffered, which is for maintaining the truth of God and the honor of my King against popish usurpations. Let God be glorified and let the King live forever." These men were loyal to the man responsible for their situation. When Mr. Burton, a Puritan divine, was brought on the platform and was asked if the pillory were not uneasy for his neck and shoulders, he answered, "How can Christ's yoke be uneasy? He bears the heavier end of it, and I the lighter. And if mine were too heavy, he would bear that too. Christ is a good master and worth the suffering for. And if the world did but know his goodness and had tasted of his sweetness, all would come and be his servants." It was the persecution of godly men like that were the last straw for Cromwell and the Puritans. In 1640 came about, as we've seen, the famous Long Parliament, an assembly of political personages, the caliber of which and the godliness of which there's no comparison in the history of the church or in history of the West. And the reason it was called is that though Charles I had been reigning for 11 years in tyranny without the Parliament, he, as always, needed money to finance his armies and his wars. And he especially needed money to finance his Irish army, headed by Earl of Strafford, he was going to bring against Scotland and then later against his own Englishmen. And the only way to get that much money would be to call Parliament to meet. So reluctantly, at Wentworth's suggestion, he called Parliament, hoping to convince them to finance his wars. But the Puritan Presbyterians of Parliament, you remember they were all Puritan and most of them Presbyterians, the Puritan Presbyterians of Parliament were in no mood to be deceived, no mood to finance the king's wars, and no mood to place themselves, Protestantism, and the freedom of the English people in jeopardy. So once the Long Parliament was called by the king, Parliament went to work prosecuting the traitorous persecutors of the English people. They arrest the Earl of Stratford, trying, finding guilty as a public enemy, cut off his head. They arrest Archbishop Laud for mutilating and killing and torturing people to death. They find him guilty of being a public enemy of the English people. They cut off his head. Charles I is the last one left standing, but not for long. All the great machinery by which tyranny was advanced in England was dismantled by the Long Parliament. And Cromwell was in that parliament. And to protect itself against the king and all of his conspiracies and his army, Parliament called for the organization of a parliamentary army for the preservation of liberty and Protestantism in England. When they did that, all the English nobles, the wealthy, who were always looking for some little more, another bone from the king, all the nobles rallied to the king, or many of them. And the names Cavaliers and Roundheads began to distinguish the two parties. The Cavaliers, those that supported the king, the Roundheads, those that supported Cromwell. The Cavaliers were the wealthy aristocratic nobles. The Roundheads was the derogatory name given for the Puritans who followed Cromwell because they had their hair cropped so short. You know, you've seen the pictures of the lords with their long flowing hair, and Cromwell's men and the Puritans had their hair cut short in 1950 style, so to speak. And it was because of that that they were called Roundheads. Well, the English Civil War began when Charles I, on January the 3rd, 1642, charged the five most influential leaders of the House of Commons with treason. You saw it in the movie, so you know it happened. The only mistake of the movie was Cromwell was not one of those charged, as the movie said. So the next day, the king sent 400 soldiers, armed soldiers, to Parliament to arrest these men, but they got word, and they escaped, but the Civil War had begun. Cromwell at this time was 42 years old, and he was the father of six children. He was living quietly at home on his own estates, not thinking of raising arms against the king, like most godly landowners of his day, doing what he was called to do there on his massive farm. But he was soon forced to realize that these new times in which he lived called for new measures. Especially when he and these other godly landowners got word of the massacre of some 50,000 to 200,000 Protestants in Ireland, with the king's probable involvement of his insincerity and his deceitfulness, of his conspiracies against the English people, of the brutal punishments inflicted upon many of their brethren in the Lord, over the Roman Catholicism of the Queen and the semi-Romanism of the King, the persecution of the Church in Scotland, the daily banishment of some of the best Christians in England from the land, and the threatening position of this Irish Catholic pagan mercenary army led by Strafford, positioned to invade England against English people to advance the tyranny of the King. It woke them up. They realized something new and more drastic would have to be done in order to protect Protestantism and the liberties of Englishmen. When everything seemed to announce to the Protestants of England that soon they would either be trampled down under popery or massacred by the sword, these godly and serious men like Cromwell arose, called upon the king to change his mind and not to deceive the people. But when they found that their own king was deaf to their requests and arrogant and deceptive, raising troops to overawe the Parliament, these godly men resolved in a spirit of prayer and devotedness, with God's assistance, to save the country and their faith. And so they left their homes and exposed themselves to death to stand against the king. Oliver Cromwell had been a great leader in Parliament up to this point. Now he was moving into another brand new role. He had shown the House of Commons how eloquent he could be in his speech, and now he would astonish the Englishmen of his courage and his genius in military affairs and in war. the fervent orator of the House of Commons, was about to become a great general and, in fact, one of the greatest military leaders and statesmen of all times. Before long, this 42-year-old man would launch upon a political and military career and become known as not only the greatest man of his age, but at the same time as an extraordinarily godly Christian. So the king raised his standard at Nottingham, rallying all of the royalist support behind him August the 22nd, 1642. The nation was at peril. Thousands of people were joining the king's army. If Charles and his Arminians and Catholics, now remember, we've already talked about this on Sunday nights, that not only was Roman Catholicism supporting tyranny, but also Arminianism was supporting tyranny. That wherever tyranny arose, in Holland or in England, the Arminians were there to support the king. And an Arminian is somebody who does not believe in unconditional election. Doesn't believe in predestination. He does not believe in the Reformed faith. The emphasis is on man and man's decision, not on God and on God's decision. And so these Arminians also joined hands with the Roman Catholics and with the Royalists to defend the tyranny of Charles I. And if these men had defeated Parliament and Parliament's armies, there is no doubt that England would have been turned into a little second-rate European tyranny. Tens of thousands of Calvinists would have poured into America, where 20,000 had already settled. And England would have become just a small branch of Europe, insignificant in the later history of the world. But something great happened on October 23rd, 1642. On October 23rd, at the Battle of Edge Hill, the king's forces were fighting the parliamentary forces. The leadership of the parliamentary army was ineffective. The soldiers were ineffective. And it looked like that the parliament forces were about to be massacred. Then on the horizon came the cavalry. Very literally. Captain Cromwell and his 100 hand-picked cavalry, volunteers, personal friends, arrived on the scene, and the situation changed. And at Edge Hill, Cromwell halted the king's effort to get to London. It was also at this point that Oliver Cromwell realized we've got to do something about the parliamentary army. The people get into places of military power and authority because they're rich and have aristocratic blood, not because they're good commanders in chief. And the soldiers themselves are unfit and untrained for effective military service. And if we're going to win this war, the whole army has to be reorganized. So at that point, Oliver Cromwell committed himself to the new model army. Remember that phrase. After Edge Hill, Charles retreated to Oxford. Parliament tried to negotiate with him for the sake of peace. He wouldn't have anything to do with Parliament's negotiation. The Cavaliers, the Catholics, the Arminians start gathering around him. And in the meanwhile, Cromwell went everywhere trying to collect the kind of men that he thought would be effective soldiers in the new model army. He wanted godly men of conscience. And as one first-hand witness said, he made officers out of men, not such as were soldiers or men of estate, but such as were common men, poor and of mean parentage. Only he would give them the title of godly, precious men. That was revolutionary, but it was to change the world. It was not introduced by the French Jacobins or the Russian Marxists, but by an English Calvinist. It was Cromwell who saw value in tradesmen, artisans, farmers, and common laborers. And he knew that if the battle was going to be won, not many mighty, not many high and noble, but God would use the weak and the base and the lowly to confound the high and the mighty. One of the greatest preachers that ever lived during that day and had a great respect for Cromwell, and Cromwell had a great respect for him, although they differed on several things. His name was Richard Baxter. And he made this statement about Cromwell building this army. He said, "Cromwell had a special care to get Christian men into his troops because these were the sort of men he esteemed and loved. And from this happy choice flowed the avoidings of those disorders, mutinies, plunderings, and grievances of the country which debased men in armies are commonly guilty of." In other words, this was an army, a powerful army of well-trained men, and it was the holiest, godliest army amassed in modern times. In the evening when they weren't, or the weekends when they weren't fighting, the army wasn't getting drunk out the towns. They wasn't gone to the bawdy and the lewd taverns. The soldiers with their commanding officers and Cromwell himself would sit around the campfires, read the Bible, sing psalms, and pray. And the new model army never lost a battle. Cromwell said concerning his own army, "Your troops," in criticizing the parliamentary army, "your troops are most of them old, decayed serving men and tapsters and such kind of fellows, but theirs are gentlemen's sons, younger sons, and persons of quality. But I'll remedy this. I will raise men who will have the fear of God before their eyes, and who will bring some conscience to what they do, and I promise you they shall not be beaten." Be an honor to serve in an army like that, wouldn't it? So, 14 squadrons of zealous, godly Protestants were soon raised. Cromwell's own regiment wanted to organize itself into a church. Can you imagine? They said, "We got elders, we got deacons, we got Christians. Let's just organize our regiment into a church. And let's call the Presbyterian Richard Baxter to be our pastor." Shows you the tolerance of Cromwell, who was not a Presbyterian. More than that, Richard Baxter was a royalist who wanted King Charles back on the throne. But Cromwell wanted the Calvinistic preaching of Richard Baxter. Otto Scott says, "It remains puzzling that Cromwell's use of biblical principles in military recruitment, which were so successful in his day, has never been imitated. Cromwell's men became steadily more famous for being religious, obedient, fearless, disciplined. They were the true representatives of the ignored and despised and beaten down people of England." And one thing you must understand about the English Civil War and Cromwell, and that is that this whole revolution, this whole Civil War, was not fought so much against tyranny as it was against Roman Catholicism. And it was not fought so much against Roman Catholicism as it was fought against Arminianism. Cromwell was afraid that England would become an Arminian country, no longer reformed, no longer holding to the basic principles of the Protestant Reformation. If she became Arminian, it would just be one step before she became Roman Catholic. And then tyranny would flourish throughout the land. There was another great battle in which Cromwell's army faced off against the king at Marston Moor. Prince Rupert, you saw him in the movie, you remember? So you know what he looks like. Prince Rupert was leading the king's army at Marston Moor, and he was driven from the field by Cromwell. Rupert escaped with 6,000 of his cavalry, but the rest of his force of 21,000 was squashed at Marston Moor, so that to this day Marston Moor is the largest cemetery in England. The other parliamentary forces were suffering defeat. Cromwell was winning victory after victory, but all these other ineffective forces, led by the nobles with unfit soldiers, were losing right and left. Cromwell didn't want to cause a stir. He didn't want people to think that he was trying to put himself forward. But he had to think of some way to change the leadership of the army and the makeup of the army. So he proposed to the Parliament a bill in 1644 called the Self-Denying Ordinance. The Self-Denying Ordinance, calling upon all members of Parliament, of which he was one, to resign their military commands so as to pave the way for new effective military leadership. Passed. And now Parliament was on its way, and Cromwell was on its way of rebuilding the army. Cromwell continually argued that unless we rebuild this army and restructure it, have godly men, effective leaders, the war is lost. Cromwell said, the profaneness and impiety and the absence of all religion, the drinking and gaming and all manner of license and laziness in the army led to its poor performance. He argued that, quote, till the whole army was newly modeled and governed under a stricter discipline, they must not expect any notable success in anything they were about. So Parliament agreed with him. They placed Lord Fairfax as the commander-in-chief of the Parliament forces. Oliver Cromwell was second in command. The new model army was in existence now. It marched onto the field with 22,000 troops in the new model army, which was a part of the whole parliamentary army of 88,000 troops. It met the king's forces again on the fields of Naseby, June the 14th, 1645, where it cut to pieces, totally defeated, the last field army of King Charles I of England. And the next year, the king surrendered to the Scots, who turned him over to the English Parliament. On June the 21st, 1645, 3,000 supporters of the king who fought for the king were prisoners of war and were paraded through the streets of London by Cromwell's victorious troops as the entire city of London rejoiced and cheered. Charles's army had been destroyed. Cromwell was raised to the position of lieutenant general. And with the defeat of the king, the new model army was supreme in England. 1647, the Westminster Assembly finished its work. It completed a directory of public worship, a book of church order for the government of the church, a confession of faith, two catechisms, a larger catechism, and a shorter catechism. And remember now that these were Presbyterian documents. You remember the solemn league and covenant between England and Scotland, signed official legal alliance between two nations, calling upon both nations to preserve the Reformed faith in its worship, doctrine, church, government, liturgy in Scotland, and calling upon both countries to commit themselves to the reformation of the Anglican Church in Great Britain, in England, in its doctrine and worship and discipline and church government. And so the Westminster Assembly that wrote the Confession of Faith, as we know, was overwhelmingly Presbyterian, but so was Parliament. But now there's two kinds of Presbyterians. There are those Presbyterians who are Presbyterians by principle. They know what they believe. They know the implications of it. That was the men in the Westminster Assembly. They were not about to compromise it. Many of the parliamentarians were principled Presbyterians. Many of them were pragmatic Presbyterians riding the crest of the wave, knowing which side of the bread their butter was on, or whatever it is, knowing where their next meal would come from, knowing where the honors would be. And so many of these Presbyterians in Parliament, though godly men, were pragmatic Presbyterians and not principled Presbyterians. Just bear that in mind. And also remember that Oliver Cromwell was not a Presbyterian. He was a Calvinist. He was reformed in what he believed, but he was not a Presbyterian in church government. That is, he did not believe that churches should be organized congregations into a common organization and institution, but he was an independent. That is, he believed each congregation should be autonomous and separate from the rest. And as we'll see, therein was his great weakness, and that's why the Commonwealth did not last beyond him. But the Presbyterians of that day made some terrible blunders. Some inexcusable and sinful blunders. Parliament owed its protection, and the protection of Protestantism and the liberty of Englishmen, to the new model army. After the king's army had been defeated in the field, the Presbyterian majority in Parliament voted to disband the new model army. Supposedly, ostensibly, to form another army to suppress a rebellion in Ireland. The Presbyterians also required the officers of the new model army, many of whom were not Presbyterian, though godly men, to swear to uphold the solemn league and covenant, which Cromwell had done. But many of them had problems with that, because though they were willing, here's the thing about the army that you got to understand, and Cromwell, even though they weren't Presbyterians, they recognized the Presbyterians were in the majority of England, and the most Puritans were Presbyterians, and they were willing to have a national Presbyterian church. As long as those other Calvinists who were Baptist and independent all had the freedom to build their own churches, as long as the pure gospel was preached. But the disagreement they had with the Presbyterians of that day is the independents, Cromwell and his army, did not believe in imposing a Presbyterian government upon the English people by the sword, by the cannon, and by the gun, which is what the Presbyterians of that day wanted to believe. In order to make things hard for the model army, the army asked for its pay. For its back pay. It hadn't been paid in a long time. Parliament voted to give it half of its past back pay, and it made promises for the rest. Then a crisis was created when the new model army refused to be dissolved. Parliament said, "You're now dissolved." Cromwell and his army said, "No, we're not." Now the situation is, prior to this, it was Parliament versus King. The King's been whipped, pretty much so. Now the situation is Parliament versus Army. The new model army had arrested the King. Parliament was shocked. It was deeply frightened. What in the world can the army do to us if it arrests the King? So they immediately voted to pay the army the rest of its back pay. At this point in time, Parliament was smaller than usual. 1647. The Arminians and the supporters of the king had left in 1641. They had their own little illegal parliament out there in Oxford. This smaller parliament was now dominated by Presbyterians. But these Presbyterians believed that it was their avowed duty to keep the king on his throne as long as he promised to be the head of a Presbyterian national church and use his authority to guarantee a national church. The Presbyterians were willing to keep the bloodthirsty tyrant Charles on the throne if he signed the solemn league and covenant and if he promised to support and enforce a Presbyterian church in England. Brilliant bunch, weren't they? So, when the army refused to disband, and Parliament recognized that they lost all control over the army, there was a great battle, a great conflict, so to speak, between the two. Parliament wouldn't cooperate. They used the media, they used the pulpits to condemn Cromwell and the new model army for arresting the king. But Cromwell, who had taken the oath of the covenant and who promised God that he would work to reform the Church of England according to the standard of the best reformed churches of Europe and Scotland, and his army were not trying to abolish Presbyterianism from England. They wanted to preserve the freedom of Christian conscience under the Word of God in England. The army tried to negotiate with the king. Maybe we can work out some plan. I mean, we don't want to do anything drastic to the king. And every time the army tried to negotiate with the king would prove deceitful. And so the army realized it was a futile cause to try to negotiate with him. So on August the 6th, 1647, the new model army, 18,000 strong, marched into London with their prisoner, the king of England. There were two great problems that plagued Oliver Cromwell all of his life, and after his death eventually opened the door for the return of the Stuart kings, and with them greater oppression than before Cromwell. And those two problems that continually plagued him were the English and Scottish and Presbyterian royalists, who believed, naive enough to believe the king whenever he said, "You let me back on the throne and I'll set up a Presbyterian church in this country, get rid of the Episcopal church, and we'll have it, no Catholic church, we'll have a Presbyterian church for 3 years as long as you give me an army to protect myself." And these people were so anxious to have a Presbyterian church, even at the force of arms rather than by the force of ideas, that they gave in to the king's demands. And that was a constant problem with Cromwell throughout his life, of trying to keep these English and Scottish Presbyterian royalists from putting the king back on the throne. And then the other great problem was all of the religious sects, S-E-C-T-S, in England. Remember, he was an independent. Things were pretty chaotic. And as a result, his independent attitude was sort of sympathetic with all these various other groups. Even though he didn't share their doctrine, he did believe that everybody ought to have the right to preach whatever they want within certain reason bounds, that is, the general boundaries of the fundamentals of the Word of God and of the Reformed faith. But because he was an independent, he couldn't really deal with these things effectively. And so they took advantage of the fact that he wasn't a Presbyterian but an independent. And these various sects began to spring up everywhere. And the ones that he had the most problems with were the levelers. He had problems with the levelers and the diggers and the fifth monarchy men particularly. Now, who were the diggers? Well, the diggers were basically communists. They wanted an end of private property, an end of all social distinctions where everybody had the same amount. The diggers, where you could dig in the common land that nobody owned. The diggers. Then you had the fifth monarchy men. By and large, these were Christians who believed that the book of Revelation was for right now and that Christians need to institute Christian things right now without any wisdom. I mean, they were revolutionary and many times violent. But the biggest and most powerful sect was the levelers. We need to know about levelers because in many ways, although early America was shaped by the Westminster Assembly and by the great biblical political principles of true republicanism of Cromwell, modern America, since the war between the states, has been shaped more by the philosophy and political outlook of the levelers. This is a leveler society in which we live, and it has been for over 100 years. Who were the levelers? The levelers were people led by a man named John Lilburn and another man with a suitable name, John Wildman. Eventually, these men would start mutinies in the army and they'd have to be arrested and imprisoned. But the levelers believed that every man in England had the right to vote. And Cromwell believed that only those who were virtuous, men of godliness and responsibility, should have the right to vote. Now, are you a leveler? You see, if you believe in universal suffrage, if you believe that, and by the way, modern America is even more liberal than the levelers, because the levelers didn't believe that slaves nor women should vote, nor children. If you believe that everybody has the right to vote by virtue of the fact that he is 18 years old and above, you're a leveler. You're not a Protestant at that point. You're not a Puritan at that point, and certainly not a Presbyterian at that point. You are a leveler. And you got to ask yourself in the scriptures, to whom does the Bible give the right to vote? And is voting a right anyway? Members of church in good standing and landowners have the right to vote. That may or may not be carried just a little too far. But nevertheless, Cromwell had a great problem with the levelers, though he sympathized with them. They were against tyranny. He was against tyranny. But he wasn't about to go as far as they went, although under their pressure, because there were so many of them, eventually he did give in a little and said that everybody who fought in the new model army could vote. Well, Cromwell was just repel by the sweeping nature of the leveler proposals. He believed, now listen, he believed and others believed that a man without any more than fixed property than what he may carry about with him, a man who is here today and gone tomorrow, would be enabled by numbers to enact confiscatory laws. This debate carried matters almost to the brink. It is remarkable that Cromwell was able to moderate the debate. Cromwell agreed that men who had fought should have the right to vote. To expand the vote to all might be to lose all. For the people might vote a king or a tyrant back in power. And it is historically documented that democracies degenerate into tyrannies. You look at the great Greek democracies of the ancient world, what democracies they were, they degenerated into tyrannies. Cromwell, like our founding fathers, wanted a republic, not a democracy in England. And like our American Virginian founding fathers, he wanted an aristocratic republic and not a democracy. Now you got to know the difference here, and I'm sure all of you do. To understand history and what's happening to our language, a democracy made up of two Greek words means literally mob rule. A democracy is where the majority rules regardless of the law. Direct involvement of the majority in the governing of the land. A republic is a nation governed by constitutional law, which law is administered by those representatives of that constitution elected by the people. In a democracy, nothing is safe because the majority of voters can easily be led and manipulated and are easily led and manipulated by power brokers, by media, education, church, politicians to vote in whatever way they say or they think. And in a democracy where the whims and the fancies of the majority rule, nothing's safe. If the majority says all babies are susceptible to abortion, no little babies are safe. If the majority say that there should be the forced redistribution of the wealth, nobody's property safe. But in a republic where constitutional law reigns, if people want to murder unborn babies are safe because the law says thou shalt not kill. And if they want to forcibly redistribute the wealth, they can't because the law says thou shalt not steal. And in the Bible, there was not democracy. I mean, today we talk about democracy, 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 democracy. Democracy never solves anything. You look at the democracies of, we've worked to have democracies in South America and Central America, haven't we? Virtually every democracy we've established in Central and South America has elected another tyrant. Look at America. What is it the Bible tells us? The Bible tells us that the government is a representative government elected by representatives to administer constitutional law. No one man is the source of law. No part of government is above the law. It's all accountable to it. You remember the Stuarts thought they were above the law. And that was one of the great conflicts and great disagreements in the English Civil War. But now you have this conflict within the good guys' camp itself. And the leveler saying, let's go farther than what we have gone, and let's have a full-fledged democracy with universal suffrage. Regardless of what a man believes, regardless of what he professes, every man should have the right to vote. Cromwell, being a godly man who only wanted godly people around him and godly people in his army, was repulsed at the idea of allowing men who were ungodly and irresponsible to have a part in the ruling of the Commonwealth of England. He wanted a morally aristocratic republic where the people who held office, the people who held vote, who could vote, were morally superior. And that's what our founding fathers wanted as well. So he was constantly plagued by the English, Scottish, Presbyterian royalists, always trying to get the king back because they were too stupid not to believe him. And the levelers, who wanted to go off in a more revolutionary direction and leave republican foundations for pure democracy, which Cromwell knew would only lead to more tyranny. Well, let's quit there for this evening. Let's pray. We thank you, Lord, for the courage and the godliness and the wisdom of Oliver Cromwell. We thank you for the encouragement of his testimony and of his life and of his efforts. We thank you for the influence of this man upon our country to this very day, in a lesser degree than in earlier days, and hopefully to a greater degree in the future. Lord, help us to learn from his strengths and from the truths that he believed. Help us to avoid his mistakes and march on under the banner of Christ to an even greater future, when all tyranny will be put down, when people will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, when the oppressors will be the servants of the church and the kings be the church's nursings, fathers and mothers. For the sake of Christ, the King, we pray. Amen.